The people of London revolted, and, in alliance with the troops of Stephen, besieged her at Winchester, where they took her brother Robert prisoner, whom, as her best soldier and chief general, she was glad to exchange for Stephen himself, who thus regained his liberty. Then, the long war went on afresh. Once, she was pressed so hard in the castle of Oxford, in the winter weather when the snow lay thick upon the ground, that her only chance of escape was to dress herself all in white, and, accompanied by no more than 3 faithful knights, dressed in like manner that their figures might not be seen from Stephenotia's camp as they passed over the snow, to steal away on foot, cross the frozen Thames, walk a long distance, and at last gallop away on horseback. All this she did, but to no great purpose then, for her brother dying while the struggle was yet going on, she at last withdrew to Normandy. In 2 or 3 years after her withdrawal her cause appeared in England, afresh, in the person of her son Henry, young Plantagenet, who, at only 18 years of age, was very powerful, not only on account of his mother having resigned all Normandy to him, but also from his having married Eleanor, the divorced wife of the French king, a bad woman, who had great possessions in France. Louis, the French king, not relishing this arrangement, helped Eustace, King Stephenotia's son, to invade Normandy. But Henry drove their united forces out of that country, and then returned here, to assist his partisans, whom the king was then besieging at Wallingford upon the Thames. Here, for 2 days, divided only by the river, the two armies lay encamped opposite to one another on the eve, as it seemed to all men, of another desperate fight, when the Earl of Arundel took heart and said a that it was not treasonable to prolong the unspeakable miseries of 2 kingdoms to minister to the ambition of 2 princes. Atm. Many other noblemen repeating and supporting this when it was once uttered, Stephen and young Plantagenet went down, each to his own bank of the river, and held a conversation across it, in which they arranged a truce, very much to the dissatisfaction of Eustace, who swaggered away with some followers, and laid violent hands on the Abbey of St. Edmund at Amesbury, where he presently died mad. The truce led to a solemn council at Winchester, in which it was agreed that Stephen should retain the crown, on condition of his declaring Henry his successor, that William, another son of the king at Amesbury, should inherit his father at Amesbury's rightful possessions, and that all the crown lands which Stephen had given away should be recalled, and all the castles he had permitted to be built demolished. Thus terminated the bitter war, which had now lasted 15 years, and had again laid England waste. In the next year Stephen died, after a troubled reign of 19 years. Although King Stephen was, for the time in which he lived, a humane and moderate man, with many excellent qualities, and although nothing worse is known of him than his usurpation of the crown, which he probably excused to himself by the consideration that King Henry I was a usurper to her, which was no excuse at all. The people of England suffered more in these dread 19 years, than at any former period even of their suffering history. In the division of the nobility between the 2 rival claimants of the crown, and in the growth of what is called the feudal system, which made the peasants the born vassals and mere slaves of the barons, every noble had his strong castle, where he reigned the cruel king of all the neighboring people. Accordingly, he perpetrated whatever cruelties he chose. And never were worse cruelties committed upon earth than in wretched England in those 19 years. The writers who were living then described them fearfully. They say that the castles were filled with devils rather than with men, that the peasants, men and women, were put into dungeons for their gold and silver, were tortured with fire and smoke, were hung up by the thumbs, were hung up by the heels with great weights to their heads, were torn with jagged irons, killed with hunger, broken to death in narrow chests filled with sharp pointed stones, murdered in countless fiendish ways. In England there was no corn, no meat, no cheese, no butter, there were no tilled lands, no harvests, ashes of burnt towns, and dreary wastes, were all that the traveller, fearful of the robbers who prowled abroad at all hours, would see in a long diatomaceous journey, and from sunrise until night, he would not come upon a home. The clergy sometimes suffered, and heavily too, from pillage, but many of them had castles of their own, and fought in helmet and armor like the barons, and drew lots with other fighting men for their share of booty. The Pope, or Bishop of Rome, on King Stephanotiamus resisting his ambition, laid England under an interdict at one period of this reign, which means that he allowed no service to be performed in the churches, no couples to be married, no bells to be rung, no dead bodies to be buried. Any man having the power to refuse these things, no matter whether he were called a pope or a poulterer, would, of course, have the power of afflicting numbers of innocent people. That nothing might be wanting to the miseries of King Stephanotiamus' time, the Pope threw in this contribution to the public store, not very like the widow TMS contribution, as I think, when our Saviour sat in Jerusalem over against the treasury, and she threw in 2 mites, which make a farthing. ATM Chapter CO England under Henry II Part the First, Henry Plantagenet, when he was but 21 years old, quietly succeeded to the throne of England, according to his agreement made with the late King of Winchester. 6 weeks after Stephanotiamus' death, he and his queen, Eleanor, were crowned in that city, into which they rode on horseback in great state, side by side, amidst much shouting and rejoicing, and clashing of music, and strewing of flowers. The reign of King Henry II began well. The king had great possessions, and, what with his own rights, and what with those of his wife, was lord of 1/3 part of France. He was a young man of vigor, ability, and resolution, and immediately applied himself to remove some of the evils which had arisen in the last unhappy reign. He revoked all the grants of land that had been hastily made, on either side, during the late struggles. He obliged numbers of disorderly soldiers to depart from England, he reclaimed all the castles belonging to the crown, and he forced the wicked nobles to pull down their own castles, to the number of 1,100, in which such dismal cruelties had been inflicted on the people. The King Otiam's brother, Geoffrey, rose against him in France, while he was so well employed, and rendered it necessary for him to repair to that country, where, after he had subdued and made a friendly arrangement with his brother, who did not live long, his ambition to increase his possessions involved him in a war with the French king, Louis, with whom he had been on such friendly terms just before, that to the French king Otiam's infant daughter, then a baby in the cradle, he had promised one of his little sons in marriage, who was a child of 5 years old. However, the war came to nothing at last, and the Pope made the two kings friends again. The clergy, in the troubles of the last reign, had gone on very ill indeed. There were all kinds of criminals among them, murderers, thieves, and vagabonds, and the worst of the matter was, that the good priests would not give up the bad priests to justice, when they committed crimes, but persisted in sheltering and defending them. The king, well knowing that there could be no peace or rest in England while such things lasted, resolved to reduce the power of the clergy, and, when he had reigned 7 years, found, as he considered, a good opportunity for doing so, in the death of the Archbishop of Canterbury. I will have for the new Archbishop, ATM thought the king, a friend in whom I can trust, who will help me to humble these rebellious priests, and to have them dealt with, when they do wrong, as other men who do wrong are dealt with. ATM so, he resolved to make his favorite, the new Archbishop, and this favorite was so extraordinary a man, and his story is so curious, that I must tell you all about him. Once upon a time, a worthy merchant of London, named Gilbert Atilda Becket, made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and was taken prisoner by a Saracen lord. This lord, who treated him kindly and not like a slave, had one fair daughter, who fell in love with the merchant, and who told him that she wanted to become a Christian, and was willing to marry him if they could fly to a Christian country. The merchant returned her love, until he found an opportunity to escape, when he did not trouble himself about the Saracen lady, but escaped with his servant Richard, who had been taken prisoner along with him, and arrived in England and forgot her. The Saracen lady, who was more loving than the merchant, left her father at TMS house in disguise to follow him, and made her way, under many hardships, to the seashore. The merchant had taught her only two English words, for I suppose he must have learnt the Saracen tongue himself, and made love in that language, of which London was one, and his own name, Gilbert, the other. She went among the ships, saying, "A London, London," ATM over and over again, until the sailors understood that she wanted to find an English vessel that would carry her there, so they showed her such a ship, and she paid for her passage with some of her jewels, and sailed away. Well, the merchant was sitting in his counting house in London one day, when he heard a great noise in the street, and presently Richard came running in from the warehouse, with his eyes wide open and his breath almost gone, saying, "Hey, master, master, here is the Saracen lady." ATM the merchant thought Richard was mad, but Richard said, "Ah no, master. As I live, the Saracen lady is going up and down the city, calling Gilbert, Gilbert." ATM then, he took the merchant by the sleeve, and pointed out of window, and there they saw her among the gables and water spouts of the dark, dirty street, in her foreign dress, so forlorn, surrounded by a wondering crowd, and passing slowly along, calling Gilbert, Gilbert. When the merchant saw her, and thought of the tenderness she had shown him in his captivity, and of her constancy, his heart was moved, and he ran down into the street, and she saw him coming, and with a great cry fainted in his arms. They were married without loss of time, and Richard, who was an excellent man, danced with joy the whole day of the wedding, and they all lived happy ever afterwards. This merchant and this Saracen lady had one son, Thomas A. Tilda Becket. He it was who became the favorite of King Henry II. He had become chancellor, when the king thought of making him archbishop. He was clever, gay, well educated, brave, had fought in several battles in France, had defeated a French knight in single combat, and brought his horse away as a token of the victory. He lived in a noble palace, he was the tutor of the young Prince Henry, he was served by 140 knights, his riches were immense. The king once sent him as his ambassador to France, and the French people, beholding in what state he travelled, cried out in the streets, "How splendid must the King of England be, when this is only the Chancellor." ATM they had good reason to wonder at the magnificence of Thomas A. Tilda Becket, for, when he entered a French town, his procession was headed by 250 singing boys, then, came his hounds in couples, then, 8 wagons, each drawn by 5 horses driven by 5 drivers, 2 of the wagons filled with strong ale to be given away to the people, 4, with his gold and silver plate and stately clothes, 2, with the dresses of his numerous servants. Then, came 12 horses, each with a monkey on his back, then, a train of people bearing shields and leading fine war horses splendidly equipped, then, falconers with hawks upon their wrists, then, a host of knights, and gentlemen and priests, then, the chancellor with his brilliant garments flashing in the sun, and all the people capering and shouting with delight. The king was well pleased with all this, thinking that it only made himself the more magnificent to have so magnificent a favorite, but he sometimes jested with the chancellor upon his splendor too. Once, when they were riding together through the streets of London in hard winter weather, they saw a shivering old man in rags. "Look at the poor object." "ATM," said the king. "Would it not be a charitable act to give that aged man a comfortable warm cloak?" "ATM, undoubtedly it would," ATM said Thomas A. Tilda Becket. "And you do well, sir, to think of such Christian duties." "ATM, come." "ATM," cried the king. "Then give him your cloak." ATM it was made of rich crimson trimmed with ermine. The king tried to pull it off. The chancellor tried to keep it on, both were near rolling from their saddles in the mud, when the chancellor submitted, and the king gave the cloak to the old beggar, much to the beggar at ATM's astonishment, and much to the merriment of all the courtiers in attendance. For, courtiers are not only eager to laugh when the king laughs, but they really do enjoy a laugh against a favorite. "I will make," ATM thought King Henry II, "this chancellor of mine, Thomas A. Tilda Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury. He will then be the head of the church, and, being devoted to me, will help me to correct the church. He has always upheld my power against the power of the clergy, and once publicly told some bishops, I remember, that men of the church were equally bound to me, with men of the sword. Thomas A. Tilda Becket is the man, of all other men in England, to help me in my great design. ATM. So the king, regardless of all objection, either that he was a fighting man, or a lavish man, or a courtly man, or a man of pleasure, or anything but a likely man for the office, made him archbishop accordingly. Now, Thomas A. Tilda Becket was proud and loved to be famous. He was already famous for the pomp of his life, for his riches, his gold and silver plate, his wagons, horses, and attendants. He could do no more in that way than he had done, and being tired of that kind of fame, which is a very poor one, he longed to have his name celebrated for something else. Nothing, he knew, would render him so famous in the world, as the setting of his utmost power and ability against the utmost power and ability of the king. He resolved with the whole strength of his mind to do it. He may have had some secret grudge against the king besides. The king may have offended his proud humor at some time or other, for anything I know. I think it likely, because it is a common thing for kings, princes, and other great people, to try the tempers of their favorites rather severely. Even the little affair of the crimson cloak must have been anything but a pleasant one to a haughty man. Thomas A. Tilda Becket knew better than anyone in England what the king expected of him. In all his sumptuous life, he had never yet been in a position to disappoint the king. He could take up that proud stand now, as head of the church, and he determined that it should be written in history, either that he subdued the king, or that the king subdued him. So, of a sudden, he completely altered the whole manner of his life. He turned off all his brilliant followers, ate coarse food, drank bitter water, wore next his skin sackcloth covered with dirt and vermin, for it was then thought very religious to be very dirty, flogged his back to punish himself, lived chiefly in a little cell, washed the feet of 13 poor people every day, and looked as miserable as he possibly could. If he had put 1,200 monkeys on horseback instead of 12, and had gone in procession with 8,000 wagons instead of 8, he could not have half astonished the people so much as by this great change. It soon caused him to be more talked about as an archbishop than he had been as a chancellor. The king was very angry, and was made still more so, when the new archbishop, claiming various estates from the nobles as being rightfully church property, required the king himself, for the same reason, to give up Rochester Castle, and Rochester City too. Not satisfied with this, he declared that no power but himself should appoint a priest to any church in the part of England over which he was archbishop, and when a certain gentleman of Kent made such an appointment, as he claimed to have the right to do, Thomas A. Tilda Becket excommunicated him. Excommunication was, next to the interdict I told you of at the close of the last chapter, the great weapon of the clergy. It consisted in declaring the person who was excommunicated an outcast from the church and from all religious offices, and in cursing him all over, from the top of his head to the sole of his foot, whether he was standing up, lying down, sitting, kneeling, walking, running, hopping, jumping, gaping, coughing, sneezing, or whatever else he was doing. This unchristian nonsense would of course have made no sort of difference to the person cursed who could say his prayers at home if he were shut out of church, and whom none but God could judge here but for the fears and superstitions of the people, who avoided excommunicated persons, and made their lives unhappy. So, the king said to the new archbishop, take off this excommunication from this gentleman of Kent. ATM. To which the archbishop replied, I shall do no such thing. ATM, the quarrel went on. A priest in Worcestershire committed a most dreadful murder, that aroused the horror of the whole nation. The king demanded to have this wretch delivered up, to be tried in the same court and in the same way as any other murderer. The archbishop refused, and kept him in the bishopatium's prison. The king, holding a solemn assembly in Westminster Hall, demanded that in future all priests found guilty before their bishops of crimes against the law of the land should be considered priests no longer, and should be delivered over to the law of the land for punishment. The archbishop again refused. The king required to know whether the clergy would obey the ancient customs of the country. Every priest there, but one, said, "After Thomas A. Tilda Becket, I saving my order. Atm." This really meant that they would only obey those customs when they did not interfere with their own claims, and the king went out of the hall in great wrath. Some of the clergy began to be afraid, now, that they were going too far. Though Thomas A. Tilda Becket was otherwise as unmoved as Westminster Hall, they prevailed upon him, for the sake of their fears, to go to the king at Woodstock, and promise to observe the ancient customs of the country, without saying anything about his order. The king received this submission favourably, and summoned a great council of the clergy to meet at the castle of Clarendon, by Salisbury. But when the council met, the archbishop again insisted on the words "a saying my order ... 80m and he still insisted, though lords entreated him, and priests swept before him and knelt to him, and an adjoining room was thrown open, filled with armed soldiers of the king, to threaten him. At length he gave way, for that time, and the ancient customs, which included what the king had demanded in vain, were stated in writing, and were signed and sealed by the chief of the clergy, and were called the Constitutions of Clarendon. The quarrel went on, for all that. The archbishop tried to see the king. The king would not see him. The archbishop tried to escape from England. The sailors on the coast would launch no boat to take him away. Then, he again resolved to do his worst in opposition to the king, and began openly to set the ancient customs at defiance. The king summoned him before a great council at Northampton, where he accused him of high treason, and made a claim against him, which was not a just one, for an enormous sum of money. Thomas A. Tilda Becket was alone against the whole assembly, and the very bishops advised him to resign his office and abandon his contest with the king. His great anxiety and agitation stretched him on a sick bed for 2 days, but he was still undaunted. He went to the adjourned council, carrying a great cross in his right hand, and sat down holding it erect before him. The king angrily retired into an inner room. The whole assembly angrily retired and left him there. But there he sat. The bishops came out again in a body, and renounced him as a traitor. He only said, "I hear." Atm and sat there still. They retired again into the inner room, and his trial proceeded without him. By and by, the Earl of Leicester, heading the barons, came out to read his sentence. He refused to hear it, denied the power of the court, and said he would refer his cause to the Pope. As he walked out of the hall, with the cross in his hand, some of those present picked up rushes were strewn upon the floors in those days by way of carpet and threw them at him. He proudly turned his head, and said that were he not archbishop, he would chastise those cowards with the sword he had known how to use in bygone days. He then mounted his horse, and rode away, cheered and surrounded by the common people, to whom he threw open his house that night and gave a supper, supping with them himself. That same night he secretly departed from the town, and so, travelling by night and hiding by day, and calling himself a brother demon, Atm got away, not without difficulty, to Flanders. The struggle still went on. The angry king took possession of the revenues of the archbishopric, and banished all the relations and servants of Thomas A. Tilda Becket, to the number of 400. The Pope and the French king both protected him, and an abbey was assigned for his residence. Stimulated by this support, Thomas A. Tilda Becket, on a great festival day, formally proceeded to a great church crowded with people, and going up into the pulpit publicly cursed and excommunicated all who had supported the Constitutions of Clarendon, mentioning many English noblemen by name, and not distantly hinting at the King of England himself. When intelligence of this new affront was carried to the king in his chamber, his passion was so furious that he tore his clothes, and rolled like a madman on his bed of straw and rushes. But he was soon up and doing. He ordered all the ports and coasts of England to be narrowly watched, that no letters of interdict might be brought into the kingdom, and sent messengers and bribes to the Pope at Ems Palace at Rome. Meanwhile, Thomas A. Tilda Becket, for his part, was not idle at Rome, but constantly employed his utmost arts in his own behalf. Thus the contest stood, until there was peace between France and England, which had been for some time at war, and until the two children of the two kings were married in celebration of it. Then, the French king brought about a meeting between Henry and his old favourite, so long his enemy. Even then, though Thomas A. Tilda Becket knelt before the king, he was obstinate and immovable as to those words about his order. King Louis of France was weak enough in his veneration for Thomas A. Tilda Becket and such men, but this was a little too much for him. He said that A. Tilda Becket A. wanted to be greater than the saints and better than Saint Peter, A.T.M. and rode away from him with the King of England. His poor French Majesty asked A. Tilda Becket A.T.M.'s pardon for so doing, however, soon afterwards, and cut a very pitiful figure. At last, and after a world of trouble, it came to this. There was another meeting on French ground between King Henry and Thomas A. Tilda Becket, and it was agreed that Thomas A. Tilda Becket should be Archbishop of Canterbury, according to the customs of former archbishops, and that the king should put him in possession of the revenues of that post. And now, indeed, you might suppose the struggle at an end, and Thomas A. Tilda Becket at rest. No, not even yet. For Thomas A. Tilda Becket hearing, by some means, that King Henry, when he was in dread of his kingdom being placed under an interdict, had had his eldest son Prince Henry secretly crowned, not only persuaded the Pope to suspend the Archbishop of York who had performed that ceremony, and to excommunicate the bishops who had assisted at it, but sent a messenger of his own into England, in spite of all the King at Ems precautions along the coast, who delivered the letters of excommunication into the bishops at Ems own hands. Thomas A. Tilda Becket then came over to England himself, after an absence of 7 years. He was privately warned that it was dangerous to come, and that an ireful knight, named Ranulf de Broc, had threatened that he should not live to eat a loaf of bread in England, but he came. The common people received him well, and marched about with him in a soldierly way, armed with such rustic weapons as they could get. He tried to see the young prince who had once been his pupil, but was prevented. He hoped for some little support among the nobles and priests, but found none. He made the most of the peasants who attended him, and feasted them, and went from Canterbury to Harrow-on-the-Hill, and from Harrow-on-the-Hill back to Canterbury, and on Christmas Day preached in the cathedral there, and told the people in his sermon that he had come to die among them, and that it was likely he would be murdered. He had no fear, however, or, if he had any, he had much more obstinacy, for he, then and there, excommunicated three of his enemies, of whom Ranulf de Broc, the ireful knight, was one. As men in general had no fancy for being cursed, in their sitting and walking, and gaping and sneezing, and all the rest of it, it was very natural in the persons so freely excommunicated to complain to the king. It was equally natural in the king, who had hoped that this troublesome opponent was at last quieted, to fall into a mighty rage when he heard of these new affronts, and, on the Archbishop of York telling him that he never could hope for rest while Thomas A. Tilda Becket lived, to cry out hastily before his court, "Have I no one here who will deliver me from this man?" At there were four knights present, who, hearing the King Ems' words, looked at one another, and went out. The names of these knights were Reginald Fitzurse, William Tracy, Hugh de Morville, and Richard Brito, three of whom had been in the train of Thomas A. Tilda Becket in the old days of his splendour. They rode away on horseback, in a very secret manner, and on the third day after Christmas Day arrived at Saltwood House, not far from Canterbury, which belonged to the family of Ranulf de Broc. They quietly collected some followers here, in case they should need any, and proceeding to Canterbury, suddenly appeared, the four knights and 12 men, before the Archbishop, in his own house, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They neither bowed nor spoke, but sat down on the floor in silence, staring at the Archbishop. Thomas A. Tilda Becket said, at length, "What do you want?" ATM, A we want, ATM, said Reginald Fitzurse, have the excommunication taken from the bishops, and you to answer for your offences to the king. ATM Thomas A. Tilda Becket defiantly replied, that the power of the clergy was above the power of the king. That it was not for such men as they were, to threaten him. That if he were threatened by all the swords in England, he would never yield.